When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Manchester's indie rock and roll station, XS Manchester.
The XS Manchester long player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
XS Manchester.
Hello, I'm Jim Salverson, and this is the XS long player. Classic albums discussed with the people who made them. I've been looking forward to publishing today's podcast. Not least because the man I'm talking to, as you'll hear in the podcast, I've known for a few years. We used to work together at a radio station that doesn't exist anymore, but from which XS Manchester kind of rose. But throughout the entire period, working together, seeing each other in the office every day, going out for beers, we've never chatted about his music. I'm talking about Clint Boone, songwriter and keyboardist, or should that be organist, in the Inspiral Carpets. And the album that we're talking about today on the podcast is their debut album, Life. So there's loads of chat about not only the process between writing these songs and how they came about and what the Manchester scene was like at the time, there's also a focus about the very beginnings of the band and how they came about and how they came together. Let's get stuck into it. Clint Boone talking about the Inspiral Carpets, Life, is today's XS Long Player.
How's it going, Clint?
Really good. Getting there now. Busy again, which is nice.
Good. It occurred to me before we sat down to do this that I reckon I've known you for about 15 years.
Yeah.
And I don't think at any point over those 15 years we've ever chatted about your music. We've like talked about kids and dogs and shelves, but don't think we've ever talked about actually the music you made. I'm looking forward to finding out more about the early days of the Inspiral Carpets.
Yeah, it's good timing as well because the album that we're going to talk about is actually out tomorrow, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Reissued.
Out for the second time, yeah. So we are talking about Inspiral Carpets, Life, which is certainly classed as a classic album in my eyes, and it's why it's on the XS Long Player. Do you see it that way? Obviously, you're a DJ, you work on XS Manchester, you play your own songs on the radio occasionally. When you hit play, do you kind of sit back and go, oh, this is all right, this is pretty good?
I understand its importance, particularly in the Inspiral's catalogue. It was a big moment because, like, as with any band's debut album, it's not just going into the countryside in a studio for 3 months and doing an album. It's 5 years of writing and gigging and doing pubs. And so that's what Life was for us. It was the culmination of that, everything from 1985 up to when it came out in 1990. Whereas The Beast Inside, the second album and the subsequent third and fourth albums, they were sort of written in a specific period of time, and then we recorded them in a 2 or 3 month period in a posh studio somewhere, you know what I mean? But Life was... I've got more memories of Life, the album, than any other of our albums. So, some of the later albums, I can't remember anything about them. like Revenge of the Goldfish and Devil Hopping. I don't have a lot of memories.
Yeah.
But with Life, it's quite vivid memory of it. Not always dead accurate, you know, but it's I do have vivid memories of it. And I think it's because it's such a massive moment in my life, you know what I mean? I'd from being a teenager, I'd wanted to make a record, you know, a single, get a song on a record. And I'd always been obsessed about that idea. But to actually make it to that point where you've made an album with your mates, and by this point we were professional musicians, you know, we got rid of the job, so you do remember it because it's like, you know, whereas a few months earlier or a year earlier I was driving a van around Ashton-under-Lyne for a living. Suddenly I was getting up every day and going, hanging out with my band, writing songs, rehearsing and recording for a living, and it was like just a massive moment in time for me, that.
Because you have that longer period being poured into a debut album, like you say, 5 years as opposed to 12 months in the studio, whatever it is, does that mean the album ends up being more authentic, more of a reflection of you and the band than maybe what comes later?
I would say so, yeah. And it also captured a lot of that live spirit that we had because we were a great live band at that point. Well, we still are, technically, when we do so. But yeah, it captured that authenticity of this, you know, slightly rough around the edges garage band that could also do great pop. But the interesting thing with the Life album is there's songs on there and pieces of music on there that when I joined the band in 86, I think it was 86 when I joined, there was little psychedelic refrains, if you like, that we used to use on stage. And there's elements of that on the Life album. And then at the same time, you get this this hint of where we're going next, which is massive pop tunes. Mm. Like This Is How It Feels is on that album. You know, so you've got this like really cheaply recorded garage music album. And we weren't great instrumentalists. I said that with my hand on my heart. We weren't great musicians, really. But on that is this gem, This Is How It Feels to Be Lonely, which is still played, yeah, you know, not only on the radio all over the place, but the stadiums are singing it every weekend at football matches, and there's, you know, Sky Sports are using it on cricket games. It's just like that little song in the middle of that crazy album is still a monumental piece of music now, you know.
We're going to talk more about This Is How It Feels and some of the other tracks off the album in a little bit. I want to take you back to the early days of the band, though, because you mentioned when you joined. You kind of joined the band pretty late, didn't you? They were an entity, and then you were helping them record, and then you kind of slowly morphed into a member of the band.
Yeah.
Was that an easy transition to make? And was it then a tricky path to tread? Because you listen to Life as an album, and you're, for want of a better phrase, size nines are all over it. Like, the keyboard is really prominent. Mm. As a musician, you're really prominent in it. As a songwriter, yeah, obviously, you're really prominent as well. So was it difficult to kind of join the band late and then have that level of impact?
It felt really spontaneous, to be honest with you. I mean, the short backstory was that Graham Lambert and Stephen Hall, guitar and vocals respectively, they started a version of the band in 1983. And it was called The Furs at the beginning. They were really into the psychedelic Furs. So they called the initial version was The Furs. And then before I joined, there's all sorts of kids coming in and out of the band. This is way before they made any records or did gigs outside of Graham's dad's garage. They used to do gigs in the garage, and the kids off the street would come and watch, you know what I mean? So by the time I met them, it was, I think it was 1985 when they started coming to me to record the demos, because I had a little studio in Ashton, Ashton-under-Lyne, and I just used to record these cheap four-track cassette demos for bands. And that's how I met the Inspirals. They came to me as a band that needed the music recording. And I fell in love with it right away. They didn't have keyboards. It was a punk band. It was just, you know, they had quite shouty vocals, really noisy guitar, manic drums. So I started recording them. I did two or three demos each of three or four songs. And then by the third time they came in, I'd fallen that much in love with the sound of it, because I knew that, you know, in my mind, if I could play my 60s electric organ with that band, it sounded like the Velvet Underground, because the Velvets were like that. They were a dirty punk band, and then they had these cool keys. And so that was what I imagined in my head. And I just had the audacity one night to say to Graham, and he was down, I think they were rehearsing for a gig or something, and I said, what do you think about me jamming with you with this organ? Because it'll sound incredible, you know what I mean? And Graham said, yeah, let's try it. So we wheeled the organ into the live room. Craig was sat at his drum kit. He'd only been in the band a couple of weeks. He was only 14 at the time. And I can't remember who was on bass at that point. I think it was Mark Hughes was playing bass. We went through quite a lot of bass players before we found Martin, who became ultimately the bass player. We wheeled this organ in, and there was never any discussion with Craig. I mean, we never told him what was going on. He's just like, thought I was jamming with him because it's my studio and, you know, I can do what I want. It just sounded great, and that was it. I was in.
Was it an instant moment? Was it a proper like click? Oh, this is different. This is good.
For me, yeah. Right. And it wasn't like, you know, I didn't see the future and think this is going to take us around the world. It wasn't like that. It was like, this excites me a lot, because I was big on psychedelic music and 60s garage music and The Doors and 13th floor elevators. And I was really into my 60s keyboards. And the fact that I'd had this keyboard for a few years and I'd finally found a perfect vehicle for it. I had other keyboards. I could have brought my 80s synths in there, you know what I mean? But this was like, 1966, this thing was built in Italy, the Farfisa Compact Duo. And we brought it in, and that was it. It didn't just change my destiny. It changed the band's direction completely, because nobody else had anything like that. Any other bands in the 80s that were using keyboards or organs were using the Hammond organ, which was, you know, that's like a definitive sort of sound, but mine was completely different. Mine was this really weird electronic, like screechy. But yeah, that sound over the years, I think it's fair to say, it defined the sound of the Inspiral Carpets.
Yeah. So we're talking now kind of 85, 86, 87 as this album's coming together before its release in 1990. By the time it comes out in 1990, we're kind of seeing the beginnings of the Manchester scene. We've got the Stone Roses making music. We've got Happy Mondays making music. When you released the album, did you feel like you were part of that movement at the time? Was it a kind of thing of, hey, look, we're doing this thing that's unique to the city? Or is that something that comes from being able to reflect back on it 30 years down the line?
By the time the album came out, we'd released a string of singles, each one becoming more successful than the last, as the other bands are doing as well. So by the time I came out in I think it was March of 1990, wasn't it? It felt very much like we're part of this scene. You know, I think by then, I think Madchester had been coined, you know, the name Madchester. And we, you know, our album very neatly slotted into that scene, which we were dead happy about, because it just meant that everything was going to become... We were already on our journey. We were already going to go to Japan and places like that. Yeah. We knew it because, you know, John Peel was right behind us, and it's only a matter of time before the major labels come to you. So,
is that pure coincidence that sonically it kind of fitted in with what Madchester sounded like?
It's funny because when you listen to it, we didn't sound anything like the Manchester bands, you know, and that's one of the things I like about...
But I think it's that touch of psychedelica that you kind of touch on. It's that kind of is the association, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's almost like a spirit thing, isn't it? Like the Roses had that hint of psychedelia. The Mondays did. Yeah. Even James did. You know, James was like a psychedelic folk band to me back then. So, we very much became part of Madchester, and it just meant that, as I said, everything was going to be happening a lot quicker. And it did, you know, within months we were off to see the world, and, you know, people around the world would be, journalists around the world would be saying, tell us about Manchester, tell us about... So everybody knew, you know, what Manchester was.
Yeah.
And it really put Manchester on the map in a way that previously only Manchester United had done. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's like suddenly they weren't just asking about United, they're asking about the other Manchester bands. And the funny thing is, the amount of times we'd be doing some interview in South America and the journalists say, tell us about the other Manchester bands. Do you get on with them? Happy Mondays, Soup Dragons, Primal Scream. You know what I mean? Suddenly it's like all these other like bands that became, I suppose, Britpop, you know, ultimately. A lot of them were like really, you know, thrown into the Manchester category, which was funny. But yeah, it was a great time. You know, it's one of the favourite times of my life, you know, in terms of when I think back to that period, 1990, and our records are getting played on the radio, and you'd walk down the street, you'd hear people playing out of the bedrooms, you know, along with the Roses album and De La Soul's first album. And it was like, it was a great time to be right in the middle of that crazy sort of hurricane of energy and colour. And when I think back to that period in my life, that you know, 1990, 91, it was never raining. In my memories, it didn't rain in Manchester. You know what I mean? It was just always sunshine and all the kids had coloured clothes on and cool sneakers and, you know, it's Oldham Street and just everybody was happy. And it probably wasn't like that. But, you know, in hindsight, that's, you know, my rear view vision of it is that it was a really colourful, warm and positive time. And the camaraderie between the bands was brilliant.
Mm.
And it still is to this day. It still is, you know, it's a real close community of people, you know, between all them bands, and it's I think that's a real testament to the spirit of the city and its people that that's how it is. It was never really competitive, from what I can remember. You know, we were big fans of the Mondays and massive fans of the Roses and James. So it was, to me, one of the greatest times of my life.
I'm going to ask you to pick a couple of tracks off the album in a moment, stuff that you've got memories attached to or that are significant, or you could decide why you pick those tunes, but I want to talk about This Is How It Feels that you've already mentioned. Now, I know it's a song that's really personal to you in terms of kind of the subject matter of the song, but how does it feel with its new life, if you like? Because it is sung, as you hinted at earlier, at Manchester City. They've changed the meaning, changed the lyrics slightly from This Is How It Feels to be City is kind of the lyrics now. Does that give you kind of mixed emotions that the original meaning's kind of been taken away from it and it's got this new context to it? Or is it just pleasing to see a new generation discovering your music?
I see it as a child. It's my eldest child. You know, it's like, it was my baby. I wrote it. Very personal thing, you know, a very personal experience that made me write it. And then, you know, it became a hit record and it opened a lot of doors for me professionally. If it wasn't for that song, I probably wouldn't be sat here now doing this. You know what I mean? And I wouldn't have a radio career. It's like, it's opened that many doors over the years. But to see it go off into, you know, the football world and the cricket world, and I've really enjoyed it, even though it's people winding each other up. So it's slightly negative in that respect, isn't it? But it is like that child that's gone off, it's become an adult now and gone off into the world, and it's having its own life, and it doesn't have to ask for my permission to, is it all right if United fans sing it to wind City up, which is what they used to do, isn't it, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
And then City
claimed
obviously,
it as their own, yeah.
City conquered the world and they claimed it. And then last I heard, I think Leeds United were using it, their fans were using it, one of the big Glasgow teams uses it, you know, in the same way, it's fans winding each other up. But yeah, I love it. And it's, you know, I think like a lot of artists, if it started getting used for the wrong purpose or for a message that I didn't agree with, I think, you know, collectively, I think the band would say you can't do that. But no, so far, I love it that it's, you know, it's a massive part of people's culture, isn't it? If you're into these Premier League teams, you know that song. You might not know that I wrote it or the Inspirals recorded it, but you know that song. And I often say, you know, on a weekly basis, it must be one of the most sung songs in the UK.
Yeah.
Because it's sung by tens of thousands of people on the terraces every week at one stadium or another, you know what I mean? So it'd be nice. I mean, we get PRS, obviously, when it's on the radio, but it'd be nice if we got some sort of royalty for every person that sings it on a weekend, you know what I mean?
They could put like a couple of pence in like a pot as they leave the stadium.
Oh, that'd be great, wouldn't it? I'd be loaded by now.
That's for Clint. what I didn't realise until I was doing a bit of research on this album is the version that I know that gets played on the radio that we hear everywhere. The lyrics are different, I understand, from the original version.
Yeah, I'll tell you how that came about. I've never told this story, but it's something I don't mind sharing. So the original version, the second verse, it suggests that there's been a suicide. The album version seems they found him under a train. Yeah, he had it all on a plate, I think it was. When we decided to release it as a single, we had a record plugger based in London who suggested, you know, nobody demanded it, they suggested, as you would if you had a record that had, you know, profanities in it, you do a radio edit. Mm. And this person suggested we should maybe tweak the lyrics so it wasn't as gruesome. Graphic is the word I should have used. You know what I'm saying? So it's still, you know, the final version for the single is still suggesting the same thing.
Yeah.
Black car drives through the town, which indicates a funeral. Some guy from the top estate left a note for a local girl. Yeah, he had it all on a plate. So it still suggests that, but in a less gruesome manner. And yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it probably was the right thing to do because it helped us have that hit record, which then went on to open all them doors.
How easily did you take the decision to make the change? Because you've got this bit of art that you've created, and then someone's going, well, even though it's not in four, someone's going, well, you might want to change that little bit there.
You're right. I mean, but as the person that wrote that song, I didn't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
I'd already changed something else in it, which I won't go into on here because it's quite a silly little story. But, you know, as a songwriter in a democratic band, you know, it was very democratic in Spirals. You know, occasionally somebody would say, that word sounds a bit dodgy. Let's change that. You know, so we did that. You know, and I was always happy to do that. So, yeah, I think if you're working in that democratic manner, that's, you know, you've got to accept that. And we always split everything five ways. So even though I wrote this out of Fields, you know, I wrote the words, I wrote the melody, it was still, we credited everything to the five of us, which a lot of bands won't do or don't do. And they're the ones that, you know, history has shown they tend to fall out about it when, you know, the drummer realises he's not getting the millions that the singer's getting.
Yeah, completely.
So we, from day one, we decided we were going to do a five-way split on everything, the credits, the money. And, you know, to this day, I'm glad that we did that because we're still, you know, we're a happy unit, even though we're not technically gigging at the moment.
Yeah.
We're out of action. But, we're still, I think it's given us that 30-odd years of being together is partly because we've always split everything five ways and, you know what I mean? It's a nice thing to do that. I'm not saying I'd do it again if I started a new band. I'm having everything next time.
Right, pick us a couple of tracks off this album that are significant to you or you have memory. I love the fact that you've got your phone out, so you're looking at the track listing that you can't remember what's on it.
I was saying before, you'd be shocked if you saw the amount of times where I have to get on Wikipedia to find something out about the band or about myself. It's ridiculous, isn't it? I had to go on the other day, like the Clint Boone Experience came up in some conversation. And I had to get on Wikipedia to see when I released my first and second Clint Boone Experience albums. I can't remember without looking on Wiki.
You never know whether it's right either, so you could be getting facts about yourself wrong.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. It's funny with Wiki, though, isn't it? Because I don't know if I told this story back in when we worked at XFM back in the day. I was interviewing a band. I can't remember. It might have been the Hold Steady, somebody like that. And in the afternoon, I was doing a bit of prep because I'd never met them. I didn't know a lot about them. And I went on Wikipedia to start reading about this band and get some notes together. And as I was reading down Wiki, I saw my name pop up in the following sentence, you know, like ahead of where I was up to. I was like, that's my name coming up. And I'd never had any contact with them. And what it said was at a recent Reading Festival appearance, Clint Boone in Spiral Carpets was heckling the band so loud that he had to be removed by security from the gig. I wasn't even at Reading that year and I'd never heckle a band like that. So somebody had been in. It was almost like somebody knew that I was going to be doing an interview. Was it you? Probably you.
It wasn't me.
You know, like Clint's interviewing the Old Steady this afternoon. Let's get on Wiki and change it. And then it reminded me that a few days before, my mate was a massive, not Iron Maiden, some heavy band. Might have been Whitesnake. He was a big rock fan.
Yeah.
And he told me, he'd seen a story somewhere about me assaulting one of the guys at this rock band. And I'm like, I've never met him. I've never seen him like that. Anyway, so I went on Wiki, just after the Old Steady thing, I went back on Wiki and looked at this other band, whoever it was, let's say Whitesnake. And sure enough, Clint Boone in Japan attacked the drummer in a bar, had the drummer up against some fruit machine and had to be removed by security. So somebody obviously was getting on Wiki and terrorising me a bit. But it's funny, I saw the funny side of it. I don't think the old steady did when I told them about it.
Well, let's hope the track listing's right anyway for this album. So what are you going to pick?
Let's go for something fairly conventional that you don't hear a lot on the radio, Song for a Family. So it's the second track on the album. Mm. And I wanted to just capture the simplicity of a average working class family, really. I think the first verse is, there's a man in the corner of the tap room. So it's the dad's in the pub playing dominoes. There's the kid out of the family, it's the terraces. See the kid on the Saturday terraces. His team are losing, but he still believes he's going to win. So, and then the last verse is the lollipop lady that's a mum in the family. So I just wanted to write a song for a family. It was just the kind of working class family that I am in. And I was surrounded by people like this. Yeah. We lived in a corner shop. So I saw this all the time. And the one common thing, which is the main chorus in it, that we all think is that he prays every night that his family's all right and he's got work. And that's all it is. Mm. It's just that. The sort of basic common denominator of all working class families, isn't it?
How much of this album is you observing life around you, whether it's what's going on in your life or whether it's what's going on around you in the estate or whatever it was?
I'm looking on Wiki again now.
Does it say, 50% of this album is Clint observing stuff.
I could see four songs on there that definitely, songs that I wrote. So Song for Family is about a family. This Is How It Feels is about, it's like a kitchen sink drama, that song. I'm not going to go into too much detail about what made me write it. But yeah, that's what I wanted to capture, the drama of a family where there's something going on and, you know, kids don't know what's wrong with mum, husband don't know what he's done. Directing Traffic was about the madness that I saw in, you know, around the Hacienda era to do with drugs, you know, the effect that drugs was having on people. Yeah. That's what made me write Directing Traffic. And then Sackville, closing track, was literally about, our office at the time was on Sackville Street in Manchester. We're on the second floor of the building, 42 to 44 Sackville Street, the building's still there. And looking out of our office, I mean, back then it was the red light area. That's what it was. It wasn't the village. So you'd literally see the prostitutes and the rent boys just going about the business, you know. And it was a song about that. It was an observation, not a comment. If anything, the comment was siding on the hardship that these people were going through, having to do what they were doing. So that's one of, I think Sackville's probably, as a songwriter, I think it's possibly my greatest achievement writing that, I think.
I think it sums up the album quite well, Sackville, because when you listen to this album, it's kind of got this bright, sometimes poppy feel, like you're right, it's a garage record, but it's definitely got a pop thread through it. And it feels very bright and it feels very positive and optimistic, but a lot of the subject matters on it are quite dark.
Yeah.
Were you really conscious of that juxtaposition of going dark subject matters, upbeat song?
No, you know what? I wasn't aware of it. And even outside of the album, you know, but apart from this, like I wrote the song Joe, which isn't on the album. It was a single that preceded the album, but it wasn't on it. And that was about an actual homeless guy that used to know in Ashton that lived near the mill. And I wrote him a song, and the idea was I was going to record it and then play it to him. And he died before we finished it, before we recorded it. So I always wrote songs about strong subjects, people usually.
Yeah.
The suicide in This Is How It Feels, you know, that song looks, it's very much a mental illness sort of reference in that song. Joe was the homeless chap. Sackville was the prostitutes. The family and Song for a Family. And then later on the next album, Beast Inside, writing about in 1990, I went to Washington, D.C. and met the protesters that were outside the White House. Met them one night after a gig. They're all living in tents and protesting against like nuclear arms and all that. And I wrote a song about them, Sleep Well Tonight, which again, I'm very proud of it, you know what I mean? So I think I didn't just write about, I'm lonely, I'm in my bedroom, what am I going to do, I want to get drunk? It was never like that with me. It was always something very strong that inspired it. And I didn't realise at the time that's what.
Was any of that like kind of the young man, like the angry young man side of things, the kind of like, I want to make an impact, I want to put issues right, that kind of thing?
No, I'll tell you what it was. I've always seen myself, I've always been into photography, and I've always been very visual about, you know, the way I think and the things I do, you know, I'm really into visual arts. And I always saw my role as a songwriter as being a photographer. And I think it's very much in the same style as Guy Garvey. I think he does the same things. My favourite songwriters are the ones that create pictures just in a simple sentence. So, yeah, I think at the time I was just taking photographs, but they were, you know, they weren't little images on glossy paper, these were songs, you know, photographs in songs. That's all it was, really, just observations of what was going on around me at the time.
Go on, pick us another track off the album.
Let's talk about Memories of You, track 7. So it opens up side 2 if you've got the vinyl version. And this was based around a piece of music which we'd recorded it for the album session. And I think it was going to be pure instrumental. And it's something that it had come from a live jam. We used to do this piece of music, I think, when we started the gigs. And we recorded it, real weird psychedelic thing. And then during the session, we did an interview with, I think it was two young girls that came to interview us for a fanzine. And we went outside the studio to do it. And outside, out of the Blue Studios, this is in Blossom Street in Ancoats, where the studio was now is sort of a convenience store. I can't remember the name of it, but the building's still there. We came out of the front door. To the left of the building, there was like a little bit of wasteland. And that's where we sat, just hanging out and doing this interview with the girls for the fanzine. And I think what happened was that their batteries run out in their cassette machine. So I always carried a micro cassette. Do you remember those little dictaphones you used to call them? Use your finger like everybody else. Is this going out after 9 o'clock? We'll probably be all right with that. Anyway. So the batteries run out, if I remember rightly. And I said, I've got my little micro cassette thing here. I've still got all the tapes. And I started with this thing in 1983. I walked around with it in still the pocket. From 1983 up until about 1992, I was still recording everything. If it was in the pub, I'm going to laugh, I'd record. Anyway, so I said to these girls, let's use my micro cassette. So we got it recorded, started asking the questions. And while we were talking into this, an homeless chap came along, or a drunk. It was like, well, it might have been both, I don't know. But he wasn't in a good state. And he came up to us, like these people often do. And he just started, like pretty much saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? What's that? You know, we were holding them. And said, microphone, we're doing a little interview for these young ladies here. And he kept, it kept going. It went on for about a minute or two, this mumbling. And then eventually started singing into it. Oh, memories of you. And I'm thinking, this is magic. This is like perfect for that track we've been working on in the studio. So I just let him go as long as we could get him. So what you hear on Memories of You is this psychedelic instrumental that I think it was called something completely different originally, but when we put the guy's vocals on it, and we never asked him for permission.
So did he get the royalties?
He's probably not around anymore, is he? I don't think he had long left, this fella. But it's his vocal. Wow. It's his vocal all the way through it. And then I used to do a lot of cutting up tapes and getting weird sounds and doing, not sampling, because sampling wasn't a thing back then, but making these collages of sounds and weird soundscapes. And you can hear some of that going on in the background. Like, you might hear some whales in there. I was always messing around with whale sounds and things like that. But the main vocal is this homeless chap that had a drink and, it recorded on Blossom Street in Ancoats.
Wow, great story. Before we finish, I want to talk to you about the re-release and obviously the plans for that, which if you're listening to the podcast, then it is out now. You can go and get the reissue. But I want to just finish off this chat about the album by talking about what I guess was the end of the journey for this album, or certainly within its kind of mini life, would have been the GMEX show in Manchester, because that was at the end of the tour from this album, which is one of those gigs that still gets talked about, I think, in Manchester as a bit of a legendary performance at the old exhibition centre. 21,000 people there singing your songs back to you.
Yeah.
How does that feel as a local lad from up the road in Oldham? You're playing what would have been the biggest venue in Manchester at the time to a packed out crowd singing your songs when 4 years ago you were kind of just beginning making them.
It's funny because it was a massive moment in time for us. I don't think we realised it on the night, because at that point it was August, wasn't it? July, sorry. 21st of July 1990. I only remember that because we called it 21790. We were on fire, like live-wise. We'd been gigging and gigging. We were just playing. We were at the top of our game at that point. And it was our hometown gig. It was 11,000 people.
Was that okay?
Yeah, that was the maximum capacity back then.
I did on 10,000.
I don't mind. You can do that if you want. In fact, let's use your version. Our support band was the Lars, they weren't as successful as they became or as well known, but we'd fallen in love with their early demos that we'd heard. So we got them to support us, which, you know, we were just in awe of the Lars. And it was the first gig, I think, that my mum and dad came to. So my mum and dad had seen me, you know, writing songs in my bedroom in their house, because that's where I was living at the time. And then they'd seen me, you know, slogging it up and down the country, getting in the back of a van to go and do gigs all over the place. And I think their first time seeing us live was at GMEX.
Right.
And from the stage in GMEX, the guest list was always up on your left-hand side from the stage. And I can remember looking at them, my mum and dad, and just could see they were just absolutely mesmerised by the scene. Because, we were on stage, they were playing like absolute professionals,
yeah.
which we were by that point. The crowd was singing the songs that my mum and dad had heard me working on at home. Do you know what I mean? Literally.
And you're still their little boy.
Yeah,
you're always
I still am. But yeah, so it was a massive moment for us. I don't remember being nervous because we were that. You get to a stage when you're in a band that, you know, if it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon and you're about to play to 20,000 people, you know that you're good at that point. You know you can do it, you know, even half drunk, which we usually were. Yeah, I don't remember being nervous. I remember being just really happy and content, thinking my life's going to be a lot better than I thought it was because of, you know, what's happening here. I remember Dave Booth, the famous DJ, who sadly passed away not long ago. I remember he came up to us after the gig at G-Mex, and it's a line that we still talk about in the Inspirals. He said to us, "You'll never starve." You know what I mean? It's like, I probably won't now. I nearly have done a couple of times, but I've always had Dave's voice in my head reminding me, just, "You'll never starve." But yeah, what a great compliment. Yeah, so a top moment for me, and it was the end of that chapter, as you said. I think during that gig, I think we did a couple of songs that were new at the time, which became tracks of the next album, The Beast Inside, which is a completely different album. You couldn't have two more. They're opposite ends of the spectrum in a lot of ways, those two albums. We a lot of people said to us back then, it didn't get great reviews, but a lot of people said, you made your fifth album second, didn't you? You know what I mean? So we made an album that by the time, you know, bands like 10cc or whatever get 5-6 albums in and they start just being really weird and experimental. Yeah, right. We did that as our second album. So a lot of people didn't get it at the time, but in hindsight, people have got a lot of love for that and realised that is a masterpiece as well, you know. So yeah, but the reissues, we're reissuing Life and The Beast Inside simultaneously.
Okay.
So, and Life is now on a gold vinyl edition, and The New Beast Inside is a double album on purple vinyl.
Is it as it was originally reprinted?
We've added one track to The Beast Inside, only because there's one track that was recorded during the same session for the album, which we didn't have. There wasn't enough space on the album. If we'd have put it on, the tracks would have been so close together that sonically it wouldn't have sounded great. Yeah. So we just used it as a B-side. It's a track called Skidoo. So we added that to the Beast Inside album for this pressing. But it's nice. I mean, the nice thing is about the albums that have just been reissued was it wasn't led by the band. We've still got a great relationship with Mute Records.
Yeah.
Even though we're not tied to them these days in any way, but we do work with them. We're still part of that family. And it was the people at Mute came to us and said, "Look, how do you fancy putting these albums out, you know, 30 years on? You know,
31 years on.
31 years on, yeah." And we were like, "Yeah, let's do it." So it's very much the band. You know, we're all in touch on emails. We brought Tom into the conversation, because Tom left the band in 2011, but he's the one who's singing on these records. So he's very much part of this new release. Yeah, so it's nice that people still want it, isn't it? After all this time, we have got more longevity than we thought we had when we were cutting it back in the day, you know.
Could it spark not a reformation gig, because you never split up, but could it spark live dates, do you think, if there's a real popularity behind the releases?
You know, I've got a feeling, this is just me totally saying this off, you know, on my own, that something will happen in time, some point in time, something will happen again with the Inspirals. In terms of live, I'm convinced it will. At the moment, I can't see when it'll be, partly because we're all busy doing what we do. I mean, I'm particularly busy doing what I do, and some of that is new music.
Yeah,
I'm recording new music and putting new music out and hoping to go and gig that at some point. But yeah, I think, I reckon at some point the phone will go off and it'll be somebody saying, "Right, Inspirals back on the road, what do you think?" And I've not shut that door. I don't think any of the people in the band have. But at the moment, you know, we're still recovering from losing Craig, really. That's the truth of it, is it? You know, it's 5 years now since Craig passed away. So you would have thought a year or two after that we might have done something, but it's 5 years and it's still... don't feel right yet. You know what I mean? And I think because we're all occupied with other jobs, other careers, it's not the only thing we were doing. When Craig died in 2015, if we'd have been just a professional band doing it and nothing else, you know, being a band, I think we would have carried on for the sake of the crew as well as ourselves, you know what I mean? But I said this in 2015 and 2014, it was like, because we all had other jobs. If you remember, I was doing a radio show from different parts of the country, like, before sound checks and stuff like that. Yeah, I think it was at that point, it was like the greatest hobby that anybody's ever had. You know, it's like outside of work, we've got this band called The Inspirals.
We put
our fifth album out in 2014, I think it was, and we were travelling the world, you know, and it was just our hobby, because, you know, I was a radio presenter and Graham was working for SJM. Stephen had a job working for, you know, in Manchester, and it was just like this. It was like having a really fancy vintage car in your garage. Mm. And then every couple of years, we'd bring it out and show it off. And that's what the Inspirals was until we stopped gigging in 2015. I'm sure at some point we'll get it out. It's still in there, isn't it? Still in the garage.
Sounds like a never say never slash watch this space slash other.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, that's it. I think it'd be easy to say. It'd be easy for any one of us to say, no, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But nobody's said that, and I'm not saying that. Yeah, and I still, you know, there's that much love for it, for what we created, that it'd be a shame if it never got taken out there again, wouldn't it, really?
Definitely. Clint, it's been really nice to chat to you about this classic album, so really appreciate your time.
Absolute pleasure, man. Keep up the great work.
Access Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
Access Manchester.
Unami! That's it for today's Access Long Player. Cheers for your ears. Appreciate your time listening to this podcast. It was a good one, wasn't it? There's loads more in this series for you to check out. If this is the first Access Long Player you've ever listened to, there's loads of different conversations with loads of different people, probably about your favourite artists. Sticking with the Manchester thing for the time being, there are conversations with Twisted Wheel, Blossoms, Cortinas, Happy Mondays, Badly Drawn Boy, Liam Frost. There's loads of music based in this amazing city featuring on this show. So spin back in the episodes, have a listen to some of the previously released podcasts. And if you like them, make sure you follow for more, because there's some good ones coming. Also, as every podcast says, like and review. Drop us a 5 stars in Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you're listening. Not only is it a lovely little ego boost for me, but it also helps the show grow. And I'll see you next time for another classic album on the Access Long Player.
Manchester's indie rock and roll station, Access Manchester.